Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Code and the Coding Coders Who Code It. I'm your host, Drew Bragg, and today we're joined by a very special guest, Chris Oliver. Chris, I know you need very little introduction, but for the sake of tradition, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on. I am Chris Oliver. I started doing Rails like in 2011, and since then, I've done a bunch of stuff, started GoRails in like 2014, and that led into building hosting software called Hatchbox, and then Jumpstart Pro, which is a Rails business SaaS template. You can use it for anything, but it's kind of got all your payments and teams and accounts and all this stuff built in. So yeah, it's been a long ride on the Rails train.
Awesome. Well, I'm super excited to have you on the show. For those of you who are new to the show, the way this is going to work is I'm going to ask Chris three questions. I'm going to ask him what he's currently working on, what blockers he has, or if he doesn't have a current blocker, what blockers did he recently have and how did he solve them? And then I'm going to give Chris an opportunity to share anything cool, new, or interesting that he's recently discovered or built. And it doesn't even have to be coding related. It's pretty much an open-ended question. So Chris, that being said, what are you working on right now?
Lots, way too many things, frankly. There's been all kinds of different things going on. One of the big ones is kind of version 4 of the PageM, been working on quite a bit, adding support for a lot of Stripe features like multiple line items on subscriptions, taxes, promo codes, and like just a lot of things around that. And that's all going to get, it's one of the foundational pieces of that's going to be adding a lot of features to Jumpstart, which I need for Hatchbox or, you know, Jumpstart's own marketing site and things like that. So we've been kind of integrating some new functionality like around payment methods. They have the new payment element. So you can add, instead of just a credit card field, you can add the payment element, which will be like, okay, you're in whatever country, US, for example, we'll have a credit card field, but also US bank account section and, you know, pay by Afterpay or Clearpay or whatever, like some of those that allow you to like pay later. Options like that. And it kind of is a one JavaScript thing that you drop in for all of those options. Whereas previously you would have to write code for every single one of those, which is a pain. So that's been an interesting one and is one that's also been a blocker for me that we can talk about later. But yeah, that I think is probably the biggest thing that I've been working on aside from like, there's a completely new version of Hatchbox that's in beta and will be coming out very soon, but it's also awesome. Got its little teething issues, you know, as you sure. Build something, rebuild it completely from scratch. Like we did, it's a lot of edge cases and things that you run into or little warts that you're like, you know, you wrote some code and you thought it was going to be something that would be robust and like wouldn't break. And then you get it in production with different users and you're like, this is not reliable. Like I thought it was going to be in certain areas. And it's interesting to like tease those things out. We're trying to be thorough on everything before we launch the new version. Like the old version has a bunch of those same issues, but like they're just kind of going to be accepted. Like right. The tools we chose are the tools we chose. And some of them are not very easy to work with, like SSL certificates. Registering those is way easier in the new version, but the old one is like, well, we run a script and you have to set up your domains correctly. There's no way for us to magically fix it. But the way that it works in the new version is like, it is kind of magically fixed because you make the request and it'll register the SSL cert during that request, which is super cool. So yeah, lots of other things going on as well, but those are probably the two major ones I've been spending most of my time on.
Also, GoRails has its first employee too. You just hired Colin Gilbert, is now the first ever GoRails employee. And what was that like, bringing on someone? Like, what was the decision behind, all right, I have a lot going on, I need to hire someone?
Yeah. Oh God. It's interesting. Like I know I've needed to hire for very, very long time, but there's so much extra work that comes into play with that. You've got to do your 401k and matching and your insurance and whatever else. Like there's just a ton of other things, payroll stuff and health insurance and whatnot. There's just lots of HR work and things. The second that you hire anybody, it's like, you also are paying them your salary plus all these other costs on top of that. And it's like just very expensive and time consuming to go train this person as well on top of that when you're already one busy person. So that has been like, I would say starting in December or something, it was like 4 months of work trying to do HR stuff just to get all of it working and figured out, which is a good thing though, because now the processes are kind of in place and it should be really easy to hire another person in the future, which we've been hinting at or teasing each other about, like, what if we did an apprenticeship kind of thing? Like Colin and I have been talking about that. Like, what if we don't hire people who are too far? Like, we don't want to hire a senior, because if we hire somebody more junior or an apprentice or something, we can teach them stuff. We can use that to like make screencasts and tutorials and things, and also give people an opportunity that they wouldn't get very easily otherwise. Yeah. You probably saw the job board at RailsConf. Like, the apprenticeship section was pretty barren, and the like senior area was like just cram packed with jobs.
Oh yeah. And we run into that at work also. We're hiring, we've got job recs, but we're stuck. Like, we would love to bring on a junior and be able to train them up. We just don't have the current resources for it. It's a goal, but like that is an awesome program for you, because you're in that unique position of like, hey, we're doing training and education via the screencast. So if we bring someone on, we just make screencasts over every pain point they hit. We're just helping to train the next generation of Rails engineers. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And long term, I would love to figure out something that we could do to help companies like where you work, that maybe it's kind of a, you can work with Go Rails, or we can build out some curriculum or something that could be like a bootcamp-esque thing where you could hire a junior, run them through our program or something, and do some onboarding into your own products and stuff that you're working on day to day, and you know, have some other support on that. So it's not just your team, where it would be like, yeah, you would have to pair program with them every day for 6 months or whatever to get them up to speed, even on some of the basic stuff, probably, if they're a junior. And then maybe that's something that could be a shared burden with some other programming bootcamp-esque thing. It wouldn't be really a bootcamp necessarily, but sort of the apprenticeship program content. Maybe we could like supply that or whatever. Yeah, I don't know how that'll look or turn out, but I know that Thoughtbot had a really like thorough apprenticeship documentation and everything that I always thought was awesome. And I just wish, you know, there was something to help more juniors get those jobs. And that's probably what we're missing the most. And also, that is one of the pieces that makes a language or a framework popular. So having lots of those like beginner jobs, is those people are looking for opportunities they can, you know, start their career with. And if you can't start your career in Rails, we're just going to all get old and have nobody to, you know, pick up the torch. So we're going to end up like COBOL or something if we don't, you know, work on that piece. So to me, that seems like a really important thing to work on. But yeah, it's been good. I kind of cheated a bit. Colin already had a year of experience under his belt. So like, it wasn't like hiring someone who'd never had a job before. He had been through the fire on all of that. And so, you know, he was somebody you could pick up and put in production work. And he already understood, how does that work? How do you have to be careful with maintaining production data and code and all of that stuff, which is not necessarily something juniors or apprentices have done. They've built their own little apps, but they probably don't have thousands and thousands of users relying on it with zero downtime and whatnot. So, but it's been good. It's been interesting too, to see like, oh wow, you know, I have an employee and I really need like at least five others because there's so much going on. It's been eye-opening to see like, hey, you've been doing way too much by yourself for way too long. And it's very clear now that there's a lot of work that should be delegated and stuff. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe over the next couple of years or something, we'll expand some more or whatever. But this whole building a house thing has been eating me alive. And once that's done, then we'll have a baby on the way. So I've been like planning for all these things, and you know, October's going to roll around. We'll have a baby, and then I will definitely want some more help, or we'll need to like spend a bunch of time this summer, you know, making screencasts or whatever ahead of time.
Well, you don't think you're going to have free time with a new baby? They don't do anything. They just sit around. Yeah. Come on, you'll be fine.
I'm sure there'll be some crying in the background of the screencasts around that time.
Have to incorporate it into the remote Ruby podcast, just like crying in the background. Hold on, Chris will be right back.
And it'll be me crying.
That's awesome about getting the first employee in. Like you said, like Colin had experience, but also Colin's like, he's wicked smart. And
he's awesome.
He's such a cool dude and so eager to learn. Like, that's the other thing I think makes hiring hard, is you do need to have a little bit of experience because you need to be able to stand on your own two legs. But that's what we try and focus on, is finding the people who are so eager to learn and who are going to be able to, in a way, teach themselves. But Colin's definitely a great choice for someone who's like junior enough to teach things to, but can also stand on his own two legs.
Yeah, I think what Colin and I were just talking about with regards to like an apprenticeship thing was exactly that. Like, we want, if we're going to hire or have an apprenticeship thing happening, we want people like him who actually listened to Remote Ruby and then reached out to people after hearing the episode and like did the legwork to stand out, and they like actually got involved and met the right people and put themselves out there. And if people are going and jumping through those hurdles to find their first job or whatever, that's noticeable. Like, those people stand out. You'll see them on Twitter engaging in conversations and, you know, asking really good questions. They clearly want to learn, you know, and they're willing to put themselves out there. And that's like the perfect person for those opportunities. Like, you know, without even having worked with them, that they're going to put in the work and learn the stuff, because that's like, they're so excited about it. And that is the qualities I think we're looking for. Just people trying to figure stuff out. They want to go create things, and they're clearly asking the right questions and not being afraid of like asking a dumb question, because there isn't really any. That reminded me of, have you read Richard Feynman's Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman book?
No.
Have you ever read that?
No.
It's one of the best books ever. But one of the stories in there was basically he was looking at some plans for this building when they were building this thing, and he didn't really know what all the stuff in the diagram was. And the way his mind worked was pretty much like, well, if I ask, I'll look stupid. And so I might as well just make a guess. And if I'm wrong, they'll correct me. And I might look stupid for a minute anyways, whatever. But if I'm right, then I'll look like a genius. And he kind of applies that to everything he does. So he like pointed at this thing and he was like, what about this valve here? Because he was trying to figure out what it was. And he points to it, and the engineers look at each other for like a minute and they're like, oh my God, you're right. Like, that valve is like not going to work or do whatever it was supposed to. And so he ends up like pointing out accidentally some like major flaw in the system, but he had just used his lack of knowledge like creatively to ask the right question, and everybody like treated him like a genius because he was able to just make some guesses, even though he was like, whatever, if I get it wrong, I'll look stupid, but if I ask the stupid question, I'd be in the same boat. So he ended up doing it, taking that approach, and just like everybody was like, oh my God, Richard Feynman is a genius. And I thought that was such a good example of kind of the like thinking that I think a lot of those people who stand out kind of do similar things, you know, maybe not intentionally, but they like, whatever, like, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. Like, I'll happy to ask the question and try and understand this thing. And I always thought that was like beautiful, you know?
I think someone just posted about that, because as soon as you started telling that story, I was like, wait, this sounds familiar. I know I haven't read this book, but this story sounds very familiar.
I may have said something about it at RailsConf or something, because that is a wonderful, like, I highly recommend that book. There's just story after story of things like that. So it is a really good one. Somebody who just loves figuring things out and seeing how the world works. And that, I feel like, is what we do as programmers a lot of times. Just
absolutely
see how do we like take these crazy complicated concepts and like define them as code. It's fascinating.
Distill down the complexity so it feels simple.
Yeah, exactly.
Such an art. Speaking of RailsConf, though, that was first RailsConf in a couple of years. How was your RailsConf?
It was really good, really tiring, but had so much fun. Like, it was just 3 years since the last in-person RailsConf, 2019.
Yeah.
Yeah, had been a long time since I saw all my friends in person and met you and all these other people who I've seen on Twitter and interacted with a bunch of times. But until you actually hang out in person, it's like not quite the same. So, but it just builds like the friendship so much deeper being at RailsConf in person and stuff. It was a blast. I was so tired afterwards, though. I think I slept for like a day and a half straight, more or less.
But the time zone changes are pretty brutal. Uh-huh. But I was actually just, to your point of the it being in person has just got that little extra. I was actually just talking to someone at work. They were like, "How was RailsConf?" I was like, "Dude, the conversations you get into when you're just like sitting on a couch at the Honey Badger booth, just like talking to two random people, and like all of a sudden you're like deep into this interesting complex problem, and everyone's solving it a different way, and you're learning so much, and you're like, I didn't even mean for that to turn into like a mini talk, but I just learned so much." It's like it's crazy how like you develop these really good friendships and relationships by doing the in-person stuff, but you also get this like sidecar of knowledge that you miss out if you just watch talks on YouTube, because it's like you end up talking to people about a talk or a workshop or finding out about something because you're just chilling in the hallway, skipping all the talks because you want to talk to people. And that's why I'm so excited they're back, and fingers crossed we never go back into lockdown. I'm so excited to go to more.
Yeah, fingers crossed. There was an awful lot of emails about COVID cases afterwards, which, you know, at first when I saw the COVID rules, I was like, that seems like a lot. But when you think about it, as soon as the conference is over that day, like everybody takes their masks off and goes and hangs out at restaurants and stuff for the rest of the evening. So, you know, you can't really enforce that. So it's going to end up where that's probably where a lot of those things come from, unfortunately.
Yeah. And just the travel back and forth, like that's why it was kind of silly, because I didn't necessarily want to get to Portland and test positive and then be like, well, now I'm stuck in a hotel room for a couple of days. But I was also like, I don't want to take a test when I'm home, then get on this plane with who knows how many people that no one's wearing a mask anymore, and then get there and be like, I've got this negative test from a few days ago, I'm fine, and actually be positive. So I was a little careful about taking my test the day before the conference and taking the antigens while I was there just to like make sure. But I'm still good. Saw a couple of emails about people testing positive, but so far so good for me at least.
Yeah, we got the wife got COVID in like, when was it? It was October or something. And we had to push back our wedding last year. And so we pushed it back to like January. We had our wedding, everything was good. And we got our booster sometime after that. And, you know, having COVID few months ago and then the booster, we were like, we're gonna be fine, we won't catch it. But we got it like the right at the beginning of May, and so it was just, I got it like May 3rd or 4th, like just before the cutoff, or I forget what the deal was, if you had to be recovered by the end of the no, you had to get it before May 7th, I think. It was because by the time that the conference rolled around, you would have been through your quarantine and all of that and completely out of that. So we just barely got it in time to go to RailsConf, because I was like, oh no, not again. Our wedding got pushed back, we're gonna miss RailsConf. And we were like, you know what, if we get it and we can't go, we're just gonna go to Portland and like go explore the city and like not go to the conference. We're gonna keep our tickets in our hotel and just like go see the sights. But luckily it worked out. But I think it's going to be that way probably for a little while. Just tough. So,
I mean, got to keep people safe, but definitely is so excited to do stuff back in person. Like, wearing a mask is no fun, but I will happily wear a mask if it means I get to do RailsConf. You know what I mean? Like, did you notice like the second time through with COVID, it wasn't as bad?
It wasn't really bad for me too much the first time either. It was like 4 days of it was probably worse the first time around. It was like 4 days of a fairly bad flu symptoms for the most part, both times. But my sister got it like in August of 2020, like the first round, and she still can't eat like peanut butter and stuff because she's got some of those long-term effects from that. So we're lucky that it was just kind of flu-like symptoms. And if that's how it'll be, as long as everybody's vaccinated and stuff, then like it's really not too bad because it's like spreading the flu at a conference or something, you know?
Yeah, so it's something you don't want to do, but it's less likely to cause death if it's less severe, so for sure.
Yeah, that's that was the major concern, you know? It's like if it's going to have very serious effects on people then and death, like, then yeah, this is not a good thing to do.
Right.
But if it's flu-like stuff, it's really not anything out of the ordinary for the most part. So
yeah,
you can get that, you know, just go to, that's what I lived in New York City for a year. And it was like, just being on the train from Brooklyn to Manhattan was like, you know, there's some crazy stuff on those like handles and whatever. And
yeah,
I felt like I was always getting sick there because of who knows what.
Sardines in a can when you're on that subway too, like packed.
Then of course there's all the people who, when it's not super packed, they're just like, we're gonna go do gymnastics in the middle of the train while everybody's sitting there and blaring music, and you're like, what is this?
Welcome to New York. It's weird.
It is weird. It was really fun, but it's just so expensive to live anywhere. And like, I was surprised, like, we live in this apartment building with like, I don't know, six apartments in it or something. And it's like, we don't have a doorman, but they also don't have a way to just like drop packages off. And I was like, wait, so everybody gets packages delivered to the office and then they have to carry them home? This seems like, for a city that big, you feel like you would have some more things figured out, but it's very strange.
Figure it out our way, New York way, the weird way.
Mm-hmm.
But you alluded to it slightly, but what kind of blockers do you have going on?
Yeah, it's a good one to ask, because some of the stuff, and I've talked to several people at Stripe, but going back to like the payment element changes, it's really interesting to think about the workflow of checkout for payments. Like, we have SCA now, so you've got to like stop and ask the bank for permission, and the user has to like approve that on their phone or whatever it is. And that whole process, we're in the middle of like upgrading Jumpstart to that. And I start to realize, like, we got to collect your billing address and a promo code at some point. And if you just redirect to Stripe, you can actually use or collect all that information on one checkout page, which is great. That's what you want. Just like Shopify checkout, you are on one page and you fill out your name and your email and your billing address, shipping address and promo codes, and it's recalculating the price for tax and discounts or whatever. But I discovered that the Stripe JavaScript currently doesn't really allow that in any smooth way. So we like got in pretty far and then hit this point where we're like, uh-oh. So the recommendation I got so far, and they're working on improving all this, but it's kind of like, well, you can go collect the billing address on a page before you show checkout, which will allow you to calculate tax and do that ahead of time. And I guess the same thing for the promo code as well, but that is not necessarily something where you have a step in your checkout that's like, hey, what's your promo code? And, you know, that whole flow, I'm like, I want this to work smoothly. Like, I am never going to feel comfortable shipping this in a template like Jumpstart until it's very smooth. So it's been an interesting one where it's kind of blocked me on that. Like, how do I either work around this stuff, or do I just wait until they have another update that improves all this stuff? Because effectively we need to like collect this, send it from the client to Stripe and make it a step that happens over Ajax, so we can like be on the same page and update the sales tax like section or the discounts or whatever. Right now you would have to like create a subscription, and that gives you this token which you can use to collect the payment method for the subscription. And there's no step. If you apply a promo code later on, it won't actually recalculate the invoice's value. So you have to like have this all ready to go the second you create the subscription. And that is kind of ruins the whole like flow of everything. So Stripe must be doing something different on their end in their checkout stuff, which makes sense. They own the platform. They can do whatever they want on their own website, but apparently customers currently cannot. And that's been an interesting blocker where we're sitting here like, oh, what the hell do we do? Like, do we wait? Do we want to wait? Like, you know, or do we like force everybody just for now to redirect them to Stripe checkout and then come back, which is fine, but it's also like a whole different, you end up on a different domain and whatever. Eventually they're going to like have a, or maybe they already do, like you can put your own domain. So you could have like checkout.gorails.com, which would actually be the Stripe checkout page, but still it's kind of strange.
It's a little jarring when you like click a button and you're suddenly redirected and you're like, do I actually want to be here?
And it's a totally different like layout and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not the same styles or anything. And I would prefer everything to be white labeled nicely. And so that's been interesting, but it applies not just to Stripe, like it applies to anything. So like Hatchbox, some of the stuff I was mentioning earlier, like when you register a Let's Encrypt SSL certificate, you have to make a request to them and then they request your domain and look for this like file. It just has to respond to this URL so that they can prove like you own it, right? So the original Hatchbox uses Nginx and Nginx works with config files. So you'd add your domain, we would write it to the config, and then we would try and run the SSL process and update it. And basically, if that fails, then we have to like undo the configuration changes to the version beforehand. And these are files on disks. It's not like an API that keeps state. So it's really easy for like that process to fail somewhere and just leave everything in a broken state, which is not fun. Or if you like change your servers around and you have one web server and you go to a load balancer and two web servers, that SSL certs on your first original web server. And we'd have to like move the file to the load balancer, or we would have to like reissue the SSL cert. It was kind of just a massive pain to manage these files and whatever else. That's another example that was like just a major blocker for us, where we're like, I don't know a great way of solving this. Like, it's just a giant pain in the butt. Then Caddy came out, which is a web server written in Go, and actually it has a built-in API. So Hatchbox in also, your app could, I don't really recommend it, but your app could use the API locally too. So if you've ever built an app, like Podi is a good example, you sign up and you can get your own like subdomain, gorails.podia.com or whatever it is. Yeah. They also want to support custom domains. So you could have drewbraggscourses.com and, you know, have that point directly to a Podia site, and it should be able to figure out, okay, we got this domain, we'll go find the account and find your account and render your site. It's awesome because you can use their API and just say, hey, whenever the next request comes in, grab an SSL certificate. So while that first request is processing, it's like, hey, it came in as SSL. We don't have a matching cert for it yet. Let's go ask Let's Encrypt real quick to generate a cert. And then it will use that to respond to your request. It will just kind of like pause it for a second. And everything's like magical and seamless that way. And it just was one of those things where you're like, dang, like this is the way it should have been. Nginx could have had that. You could probably script it with some Lua scripts or something, but this is like just a core feature of the web server in Caddy and solves so many problems like that. And it was one where you kind of see the solution and you're like, yeah, why hasn't it always been this way, you know, since day one? No, and it was a good one where it felt like we had taken something that was such a big blocker to the point where like, I still don't really promote Hatchbox because I don't want the support requests coming in. Like it was that painful to deal with some of these SSL issues and stuff. And again, too, like we're like managing your server. So like, I don't want to have one wildcard certificate that I created and then install in every customer server. That would be like a giant pain to manage. So working with Let's Encrypt, we can like have them register or raise our rate limit for that domain for certificates because we're kind of a hosting company. So it's nice that we can work with them. But now, instead of having to just say like, yeah, we don't have SSL at all for the Hatchbox app domain, now we can just have it automatic and every app kind of works as you would expect it out of the box. And it just works, you know, seamlessly. You don't have to turn on any configs or anything. You just removed like a giant step of the process of setting up an app for the first time. And sometimes you find solutions for your blockers like that, that are just magical. And you're like, wow, like that is, I love those solutions. Cause you're like this whole problem was eliminated completely to the point we don't even have a config for it anymore. Like you just get SSL always now.
That's and awesome.
That was cool. So, but it was definitely one that was a blocker for so long that I just was like, oh, I give up. Like, I don't have a good solution for it unless we fundamentally change from Nginx or something.
Right.
So luckily Caddy came along, and then Caddy version 2 came along right at the right time because it had the API built in. So now we can just talk to it directly instead. But it was a really good one.
Yeah.
Like one of my favorite solutions to a blocker that has been just a major one.
How did you find Caddy? Like you said, like I kind of just gave up on it. Like, so I assume you weren't Googling it one day, like, how do I solve this issue? And all of a sudden Caddy popped up. But like, was it just doing your normal newsletter reading or tweeted out about on tech Twitter? And you're just like, oh shit, this looks really good. Investigated and rock and roll.
Yeah.
Or what's the process of like, I don't know, staying on top of everything for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm sure it came up. I know I had seen it several times get posted like Hacker News or whatever, and people talking about it on Twitter was certainly another place where it kept coming up. And originally it was kind of the same issue where it was like Caddy 1, I think you had to have a Caddy file. So it was basically, I have to still manage a file for the configuration, which was annoying. At least it dealt with like the Let's Encrypt stuff automatically. So it was like, you could tell it was on the right track, and the conversations and like reading through some of the stuff, the developer, Matt, I forget his last name, of Caddy, he, you know, was talking about the philosophy of Caddy and future features and other things like that, that you were like, oh, okay, I need to keep an eye on this. And I knew that it was going to be a major pain to kind of go back and edit or modify like all these existing servers on Hatchbox. So we ended up kind of like, there's a lot of stupid issues that I made myself too. Like version 1 of Hatchbox was literally like, let's just take the deploy guide from GoRails and like make it a script. We just run it on your server, which seems fine until people are like, what about, I want a load balancer and 2 servers. And you're like, yeah, but if you do that, then you got to like choose where do you want your database or where do you want cron to run or whatever. And so that complexity got a lot bigger. And then of course you're doing that and you're like getting requests from people who are like, hey, this is cool, but I need to work with my team. And so they want to add users. And I was like, you know, hacked it on kind of sloppily. And so the like GitHub or whatever DigitalOcean accounts and any of the providers were like associated to a user, not the team. So then it became a pain when it's like, well, I created the team, but you know, my employee wants to go create a server, deploy an app, and they want to use my connected GitHub account. We got to go through and, you know, give them different options and whatever. So this new version, we ended up kind of just, once Caddy, we had experimented with it and realized like, yeah, this could be a much better solution. Once that was kind of there and we decided like ASDF is probably a better option because right now we're installing Node, just the latest version of Node all of the time. But some people probably will want to specify Node, or frankly, there's not much that prevents us from running Python or PHP or Go apps or Elixir or frankly anything. So we realized maybe we should change from RBMV and, you know, installing Node from the Ubuntu repository. Let's just go use ASDF for everything. And all of a sudden we're kind of like, yeah, literally everything needs to be improved. And it is a production thing for customers. So I don't really want to like be replacing RBM with ASDF out from underneath them during a deploy or something.
Right.
Because what happens to the currently running version? And we're not using anything, no containers. There's plenty of options for using containers. The goal with Hatchbox is we spin up servers and give you full access to them. You can break anything you want. You can add any software you want, and it's just going to work the way that you want it to, because it's just like logging into a regular Linux box. You're not in a container that can't access everything. And so that has been an interesting thing, where unfortunately the way everything was designed, version one, or Hatchbox Classic now, as we call it, it just was like, oh God, everything's kind of blocking us from improving this product. Billing is on the user. So we don't have a way for like the whole team to have separate billing from another team, like you would on GitHub or Heroku. And so we move that because that's the way that it works in Jumpstart. So we got a lot of like those learnings along the way of building Hatchbox, put them all into Jumpstart, and now coming back to building the new version of Hatchbox from all of these things that were like, you know, blockers from improving the first version. And now it's one of those rare times where I'm like, yeah, we should just rewrite it, unfortunately. Right. And it's probably been 18 months or something that we've been working on it on the side, trying to rebuild it all, and still not quite there yet. We're going to add metered billing and stuff soon. We're getting there, but there's been other little things that came up that are just lots of little odds and ends breaking all the time or whatever. The new Ubuntu 22.04 comes out and it's like, guess what? We've removed the SSH RSA accepted, you know, SSH keys, which is what we were generating. And they're like, we're just, you know, those are kind of old, not as secure, using one of the new formats. So we're like, uh-oh, how are we going to fix that now? And, you know, we just got to keep going over and over these little things that change every few months or 2 years or something. And
yeah,
it's been an exhausting process, but like, it just brings me back to maintaining your own server without the help. It's a pain in the butt, because then you got to go learn that. You learn it long enough till you forget, and you like spin up another server 6 months later and you have to relearn all of those things again.
Yep.
And it's a huge, huge pain. So it's kind of nice that we can learn it and write code for it, so you don't have to learn it, and you're kind of good going forward. But yeah, crazy stuff.
Yeah, that's wild. What was it? Just the sheer amount of this needs to change, this needs to change, this needs to change, and it needs to change drastically. That was like, yep, we're just going to rewrite this thing. Or was it?
Yeah.
Like,
it was.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was some of that stuff. We could definitely move billing around. We could move stuff around. But when it comes to servers, we can edit our application really easily. But what we can't do is like modify every server to move from RBM to ASDF and stuff. So it was kind of like, okay, do we fight and do the upgrade stuff? Because the other thing, not only do we kind of have to fundamentally change like almost everything, the other thing is if you're doing these incremental upgrades, you have to spend extra time doing the migration. So if you're going to move from billing on the user to the account or the team, that takes work. You have to migrate the data. You have to migrate your code. Sometimes that's multiple steps. You got to deploy it in several pieces or whatever. Your webhooks all have to change and whatnot. So it's like a complicated thing to do each one of those pieces. And we had like 50 of those pieces that we had to migrate. And it was kind of like, well, if Classic has been working for you and it hasn't really been, you know, preventing you from getting certain things done, then like, we'll just leave it. Let's just keep it running. And then we can start from scratch and have the new one working the right way out of the box. We'll have a lot cleaner code at the end of the day. There'll be a lot less legacy stuff there. It'll just be a lot less time in theory as well from not having to migrate and make sure that we didn't break anything every time. Cause that was kind of the, if you're migrating something fundamental in your app, you just have to spend an inordinate amount of time, like making sure it works perfect, because you don't want to deploy it and then like, oh great, nobody can pay anymore. That's not a great situation to be in. So we ended up just saying like, screw it, let's go reinvent the wheel, because we knew so little about doing it the right way the first time around that now that we've learned all our lessons, we can just do it much cleaner from the get-go. Right. So it's turned out like considerably more reliable. There are little things here and there that we're finding that we're like, oh, you know, we configured Caddy for the wrong user. It should have been the deploy user who has access to, you know, the folder where the code got deployed to or whatever. Little things like that that you pick up, like, oh, we didn't have to worry about that with Nginx because, you know, we didn't make our own systemd service for it. It just came with the one that it shipped with. That, you know, lots of little tiny things like that that you learn one by one as you go. And sometimes it's the stupidest stuff too. Like literally a file needs an empty line at the end sometimes on Linux. And if you don't have that empty line, then it just doesn't parse the file and it doesn't know what to do. And yeah, we've learned that a few times where there's comments in the code where it's like, yeah, this new line doesn't look important, but it's important. Do not delete this. So yeah.
Oh, that's wild. That's nice.
Yeah. You know, I love those undocumented features, right?
Yeah, totally. It's great. It's a fun way to spend your afternoon. Why does this not work? Why does this work with an empty line?
Oh my gosh. There's so many things. The other day, so I've had occasionally, and I couldn't figure out why, GoRails would just crash. The server would just kind of stop. And like, I'd go reboot it, and it would not reboot. It would be like minutes. And I'd go into DigitalOcean and like open the recovery console, and it would just be stuck. And I'd hit like enter, and then it would pick up, and it would continue. And I was like, oh, that's weird. So one of the things that I learned that I never cared to learn and hopefully would never have to learn again was my DigitalOcean server apparently was so old that the kernel version was like manually specified on DigitalOcean's website. And when you upgrade the kernel, it would just ignore the new ones. And you think it's upgraded and using the latest, but on their site, it was still like booting into Linux kernel 3.10 or something. And Colin and I spent like 8 hours debugging it one day. We're like, there's something wrong with our server. Like, and I've done this before where I couldn't figure it out and just like dump the database, create a new server, import the database. And here's the new GoRails server. And this time we're like, we're going to figure this out. And it started because Ruby couldn't generate random numbers because the dev random or urandom thing didn't get compiled correctly or something. It couldn't ask the kernel for a random number, basically. And all I really found was Mike Perham on some Sidekick issue that was like, your Ruby version is seriously screwed up. Like, you need to look into fixing that. It's not an issue with Sidekick. And I was like, yeah, that sounds right. Like, my situation's probably the same, but we couldn't figure out what it was. And I started reading through the like, literally reading through the Ruby source code where it generates random numbers from that. And I found the error and searched the string, found the error in the Ruby C source code, and was like poking through that, looking at like, if we compile Ruby with this flag, then it should use this branch of code here and there. And we were like trying to write little C test programs to see if we could replicate the same thing that Ruby was doing. And eventually, I don't know. I remember we didn't get anywhere really. And then we had an epiphany, like, let's check the server's version. Cause we'll spin up a new server, compile Ruby and see if it works, and then try to find the differences. And I noticed that like the kernel version was like 5 point something. And I checked ours and it was like 3 point whatever. And I was like, oh God, that's so old. That, and it was somewhere in there that I had read, you know, in Stack Overflow or something, that was like kernel version 3 point whatever adds this like dev urandom method call or something and or macro. And like, I was like, oh no, I think that's it. And then we go poking around in the settings and find that. And you can like set it to use the latest. And then rebooted the server. That stuff works. It rebooted really fast. And everything was awesome. So it was crazy. Just one of those weird things that, you know, you get in the weeds, real deep in the weeds sometimes.
That's a just what happens. Rabbit hole.
My gosh. Yeah. Anytime you get into reading the source code of Ruby itself, because you're debugging something, you are in the weeds.
Yeah. Yeah. That is some deep stuff. I try and watch Aaron's cool stuff stream every Friday, every Friday that I can, at least. And like, it's so cool, and he's hilarious. So it's always engaging, but like there's, he's just doing stuff in C code that I'm just like, nope, I don't got it. Sorry, bud. Like, I'm a reasonably decent developer, but you are way, way over my head. Oh man.
Yeah, it is. It's surprisingly like understandable once you spend some time in it. Yeah. But it is very foreign looking because it's C, you're dealing with memory. You have a lot of variables and things that like the syntax is just a lot stranger because we're like, so we're just so, you know, spoiled in Ruby because everything looks so nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing, you know? Looking at some of that stuff in Ruby, I was like, you know what? This is really not too hard to understand. Like, once you get into a few of these things, you start to wrap your head around it and it's not so bad. But to be on the level of Tenderlove or, you know, anybody like that.
Making a JIT in pure Ruby. Oh my gosh.
Or Chris Seaton, you know, building Truffle Ruby. Like, those people are phenomenal at what they do. Oh, yeah. And it's weird too, because I'm like, if you're building Truffle Ruby, you're really, I don't know that I would consider you a Ruby programmer. You're building Ruby, but you're actually spending all of your time in another language to make Ruby actually work. And it's interesting to think about Matt's as a, you know, a C developer, not a Ruby developer,
right? Like,
kind of first and foremost.
and not only just that, but like you mentioned Chris Seaton with Truffle Ruby, like there is so many Ruby syntaxes. Like, I did my talk at Sin City Ruby on like just weird Ruby syntaxes, like all these different ways of doing things. And like, there's what, 13 ways to call a method in Ruby. Like, to know all of that and be able to implement it in different ways, like that's, there's a lot. It makes Ruby really fun to work in. And like, this is wonderful language to write, and you can make it really weird, and it's so awesome. But holy crap, there's writing any kind of other version for it or parser or implementing it in a different language is wild, because there's just so many edge cases. I got a fun night pairing with Kevin Newton on Syntax Tree and like going through some of the nodes that he was coming up with and some of the weird edge cases. Was so fun and enlightening on like how Ruby works under the hood, but also like, damn, this is a headache and a half to write a parser for.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's why syntax, you know, with types and everything seems to be so much easier to write a compiler for, because less of it is happening dynamically at runtime. You can kind of go through everything ahead of time with types and say like, yep, this is all correct. But in Ruby, it's like, well, you could literally change anything at any given time, even when the program's running. So we can't really do some of those optimizations ahead of time. And that's one of the beauties of Ruby, but also one of the things that makes it so hard to make as a language. Because, you know, Python is a similar language, but there's often just like one way to do things. Right. Whereas in Ruby, there's kind of a ton. And that's a pro and a con. It's a trade-off, but I think it's a worthy one, because at the end of the day, computers can and should hopefully always get faster, but we as humans will always be the weakest link in writing software, you know? And yes, not all software can, you know, allow the slow execution like Ruby does. Like, it's orders of magnitude slower than Go or, you know, Crystal or whatever, but websites don't need to be that fast. So that's great. If you're building a startup, you want to have something that's easily understandable and changeable and everything, and do that as fast as possible. Yep. And Ruby is a phenomenal choice for that reason, because it's designed for humans first. And you don't need performance necessarily when you're like building your brand new startup that you don't even know how it's actually going to turn out in 5 years. And I think that's one of those things that, like, I don't think Colin realized how much time we're going to spend in actual Ruby land versus Rails doing work on everything that we're doing right now. Like, we spend tons of time just like looking at the source code for gems and whatever else, looking at the Ruby source code.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure he never expected that we'd be in the weeds there debugging stuff to actually just get Ruby running on a server. And so that's definitely one where I'm like, you know, you have the tendency to learn Rails because it's the easiest thing. It's the closest that you can touch, you know, but it's like learning, you know, C. You probably want to learn that so that you can make a desktop app or something, but clicking a button and actually writing C code are very far apart, and Rails and like the web interface are really close. But when you start getting into gems and dealing with the source code to Rails, you called something and it didn't work the way that you thought it would. Like, you just got to dig in sometimes and see, like, why is this happening? This morning, actually, we updated Administrate in Jumpstart Pro, and we had overridden a controller that I forgot about, and it broke. And we just immediately jumped in the source code, and we're like, huh, it's looking for the dashboard instance variable, and it calls .class on it. And when we do that, it says, you know, user dashboard, and it returns the class of that, which is class. And we're like, that's not the thing it's supposed to be. And we start poking around, and we're like, huh. So the way they were doing this before, it was looking for, you know, it expected this to be like, I guess, an instance of the user dashboard. And now it's like the actual class itself. So we were poking around at little things like that. And like, this is just regular old Ruby work. It's not really Rails work to debug a gem like that. And I think that's probably the thing he's learned the most in the past 5 months is like a lot of the Rails work itself is not really Rails. It's just regular old Ruby. And I think it takes a while to wrap your head around that and realize, like, yeah, you know, if you're debugging RSpec or whatever tests, it's just Ruby. It's not anything like you don't even have to look at RSpec docs half the time because it's just Ruby, and you can just poke at the source code and figure out your answer faster sometimes.
100%. I think that was one of the biggest takeaways that I got from watching your screencasts on Go Rails. Like, one of the first like epiphany, starting to feel really more comfortable as a developer moments was just seeing how often you were just like, let's open the source code to Rails and see what's going on here, or dig in to see why this thing's happening, or turns out this is a bug, or, oh, it's an undocumented feature, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Once I started doing that on my own, not being so afraid of like this black box that's the Rails source code, and just jumping into it, like, I feel like I all of a sudden understood Rails better. I became a better Ruby programmer. I just like so much faster leveled up, getting comfortable digging into the source code. And that goes for anything, not just Rails, like any gem, anything, just cracking it open and digging into the innards makes you so much better so fast. It's amazing.
Yeah, it really does. It makes you wonder how like the .NET world, where you might buy some library and it's like they just give you a DLL and you can call functions from that, but you don't ever see the source code for that because it's proprietary. And it always makes me wonder, like, how in the hell do they actually get any work done? Because if you call stuff and it doesn't work, or if it's not perfectly documented, which it never is, right? So I can't imagine working in it in an ecosystem like that. It would be so hard.
Yeah.
But I think maybe having types and stuff like that allows them to kind of like, yep, it's a black box, but it has these rules. Yeah. And you can work with them that way. Maybe that helps deal with those situations, but I still dream of the future of we write. Okay, so here's my perfect future, and we're getting close to that conceptually, at least. So right now you have a spectrum where you can write Ruby, or you can, you know, write code that gets compiled down to bytecode, runs on your processor, right? So imagine a future where like Rails can dictate sort of, here's all of our public functions and their rough types that they expect. You could start by writing your Rails app just fully duck typed and figure out stuff as you go. And after you've worked on this app for 3 or 4 years, you start to realize like, yep, this is definitely going to take a user as an argument. This type is kind of set in stone. And eventually you can start typing everything so that eventually it could be fully compiled. So once you are a scale of Shopify or something, your Rails code could hopefully be fully compiled. And yeah, maybe some experimental pieces of the app that are still being worked on can just stay duck typed and they can change as much as they want. But you know, eventually maybe the whole application is just this one executable, super freaking fast. And yeah, you could be anywhere in between on the spectrum. Some things could be compiled, some not, you know, the JIT's kind of that concept, yep, you know, and it would be really interesting to be able to just move up and down that spectrum at any given time and say yeah, like, we're not sure this is the way we want it to work. Let's go change these things and, you know, yeah, still have some sort of rules. Like if we're going to use Rails version 7, we know exactly what we can give to those method calls and what we can't. And, you know, the libraries could do some, you know, typing-esque things or yeah, whatever, and kind of give you some rules to follow, but your code doesn't have to, but you could eventually yeah, do that. I just yeah, think that would be a cool future.
Some degree of gradual typing as things become stable and mature and the churn is pretty low on them. Just move them into that typed world where they, okay, cool, we can compile this because it's not changing often enough, but this thing that we're still kind of in flux on stays dynamic and we can still use all the niceties of duck typing here. That is definitely a nice utopia you speak of, I think.
Yeah, I think it's one where it's like the more concrete the problem becomes, the more we can just optimize it for computers. And yeah, the more we're uncertain of the future of this thing, we just leave it in Ruby and completely flexible kind of yeah, areas can be a little slower if need be or whatever. It's an interesting thing. And there's so many people working in that direction right now that
yeah,
Crystal and other languages and lots of work being done in that direction. There's just some of it that's like, oh, Ruby's slow, we're going to go create Go. And it's like, okay, cool. But that's solving an immediate problem today. It's not like solving the problem for 10 years in the future yeah, or whatever. So
I agree.
That's kind of one of those things that I've had sitting in the back of my mind, and I'm not Chris Seaton or Jose Valium who is going to just stop web development and jump into building a language, but I'll let them do that. I really like, for me, I like that middle ground of like programming and entrepreneurship and like business stuff. Yeah. It's just my favorite area to be in. So
and
I will Ruby never go crazy. And exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So before we wrap up, there is that final fun question of, is there anything fun or new or interesting or cool? And I could come up with a million adjectives that you recently learned or built yourself, or, and it doesn't have to be coding related.
Yeah. I've been really having fun lately with the new version of Hatchbox. Like it's just a lot of fun to go take something that was like rickety and then build a new version of that just feels really solid. And I feel like a lot of the stuff in Pay has happened to end up in the same direction over the last bits. Like I didn't know what I was doing. Version 1 and 2 of Pay, it was like, oh, we're going to make one-time charges and subscriptions. And there we go, we're done. But like supporting complex business models and stuff, meter billing and whatever, is like pretty tough. And then SCA got thrown into that. So the Pay Gem became kind of very complicated to wrap your head around at some point. And it's gone. And I've learned stuff since I started, like Action Mailbox is a great example of a official Rails gem or feature that takes lots of things like webhooks, delivering emails to your Rails app. And then it just queues them up in your active jobs with Sidekick or whatever you're using. And then just kind of like, okay, we're just going to take these and shovel them into the database as fast as we can, because it might be Black Friday and we're getting tons of stuff. And then your background jobs can actually take one, do the work. If it fails, it can retry it and so on. And that was one of the things that I always wanted to like solve in Pay. And the last major version solved that. So we ended up creating, instead of bolting on fields to your models, we just create our own tables that pay manages. Right. And that was like an approach that a lot of gems have used, but I didn't start that way for some reason. I should have. But as I was paying attention to the way Rails did active storage and action mailbox and things, I realized, like, what if we just like make our own table that we manage? We can ship migrations and have those be the things for processing webhooks and whatever. And that has turned out really nice. And it's been an awesome thing to like now work on pay, because I'm like, oh, we don't have any of these fundamental issues for some of these things anymore. Like, I can just go build new features instead of being held back by some of the poor decisions otherwise. Because it was always like so impossible to make a migration change, because I didn't know what models you had applied payments to. I'd have to like eager load your Rails app and then check which classes had included this module for billable. And it was like a nightmare to kind of work with. And that's made it a lot of fun. Like, some of my favorite things programming is solving a problem like that, where you're like, wow, this is cool. Like, this will never be a problem anymore. And Xavier talked about that with his keynote at RailsConf. Zeitwork doesn't really have any bugs anymore, hardly at all. And it's like done. And he should be super proud of that, because it's a phenomenal feature to add or to fix in Rails, because it has always been a piece of Rails that was never really that reliable. And now it's a solved problem, and hopefully no one ever really has to touch it again. We just rely on it working, which is cool. Outside of programming, it's hard to say it's fun, but we've been building a house. I'm sure a lot of people have heard that. It's fun at times, but it's also the most stressful thing I might have ever done. And we're like 3 weeks away from closing. Fingers crossed. I feel like if I even say that, I'm going to jinx it, because there's so many things, little things that have been happening. Like, we just, I guess, fired our carpenters and have new ones coming in. So yeah, it's been a really interesting process, because frankly, I have spent the last 2 years probably watching YouTube, learning about building houses, and the amount of parallels between programming and building a house is fascinating. And it's not like just little things. It's like the whole process of building a house. You kind of do it. You can't be as iterative, but you can in a lot of ways. If you need to delay a decision, you absolutely can, and learn stuff before you decide how you want to do it. And same thing applies to programming. I feel like dealing with your number one enemy and building a house is water. So it's kind of like dealing with technical debt in your software. Like, it's a never ending thing you have to pay attention to. You have to think about it constantly. You have to address it early. Sometimes you address it after the fact. Other times it's just nature of the business, you know. But yeah, it was really fascinating to go through all that, learn about these little techniques and other things that I feel like just had one-to-one translations all over the place to building software. And I think that's why it's so fun, but it has also been crazy. Like, if you thought of yourself as someone who just knew a little bit of how to code and you were trying to manage a team of developers building a complex product, that's kind of like how I felt. Where I'm like, yeah, I don't really know how to do all the details, but I know a high level of how to solve things. But we should be done soon, I hope. And then I'll have a new office, new GoRails HQ. And then I need to get like some sort of lighted GoRails logo on the wall behind me. And I got to figure out now how to like make a cool looking office. So
yeah, there you go.
There's this board, little circuit board you can buy called a Dig Uno or a Dig Quad. And it runs a little firmware on it that you can download. It's open source, called WLED. And this board is an ESP32, which you would use for like Internet of Things stuff. Okay. So I bought one of these, and it has power in. It powers up the ESP32. You flash the firmware on it, and then it's got output for LEDs. So in our little like theater media room that we'll have in the basement, I put electrical boxes, like six of them, at the ceiling. We're going to have LED strips coming all the way down to the floor. And then I can control them from my phone and they can do animations. So the LED strips, instead of just like changing all the colors, you can actually program every single pixel. So there's some animations that are like fire, like kind of flame looking things, nice. Or like police lights or whatever. But my favorite's the fireworks. So it's got like nice. One little, it's they're all off, and then like one little pixel will fly up to a certain point, and it's like a blue one, and then it will explode and then send pixels out in either direction.
Oh, that's and awesome.
It's super cool. So pretty soon they're like finishing painting that room and then putting carpet in. But after that's done, I'm going to go install those LED strips and then wire all that up. Like I wired it all in the ceiling, and I'm hoping nobody cut any of the wires. I guess we'll find out. So that was a fun project, because you have to like run all the wires so early ahead of time, yeah. and then hope that everything didn't get damaged and whatever until right. it's done. But I've been learning a little bit of that, been playing with Home Assistant, which you can run on your Raspberry Pi, and you can connect like those LED lights, or I have these like Elgato lights for my desk, and it will pick up any of those like smart home devices, and then you can program them. So I set it up so that if the lights are on in my office at 7 p.m., turn them off. And one night after dinner, I came into the office and was working on something, and all of a sudden the lights went off, and I was like, oh God, are these broken now? And then it took me a second, and I realized like, oh yeah, my like Home Assistant stuff's actually working. So that was kind of fun. And Tenderlove had written a little library called UART for Ruby. And okay. you can get this little blue box. You can plug that into like a Raspberry Pi or one of those ESP32s. And it's got a little laser in it, I think. And it can detect the dust particles in the air, which is cool. Yeah. So you can turn this on, program it with Ruby to read the sensor data from there. And then, you know, have some air quality sensors and metrics on there. Nice. So you can do like, because I figured we're going to move into this new house. We're going to have a baby soon. And there's going to be a lot of drywall dust and other crap in this right. brand new house. So I thought I'd buy one of these and then see if I could program it with Ruby. And it like worked perfectly the first time. That's and awesome. We went and I lit a candle and blew it out next to it. So there's a bunch of smoke, and the like readings were really low. And then all of a sudden, like really high. And I was like, ah, I guess it's working. So it's kind of cool. Just like,
that's awesome.
Using Ruby for things that I never normally do, like reading a right. sensor. We're interacting with a UART interface. Like, I didn't know what UART was. I still don't really know. I couldn't explain it to you if you asked. I guess I really don't know still, but you know, it's fun to do those other projects too, that are like not, I mean, I think it's easy as a Rails developer to be like, oh, in my free time, I'm going to go build the site in Rails. But it's actually a lot of fun to go do these not, you know, Rails projects. Cause I'd love to, what you can do is like, there's MQTT, which is, I think it's a protocol, but there's a database for like recording, you know, sensor data and stuff. Okay. And you can talk over MQTT to other devices. And there's a whole ecosystem of things. But I was going to like basically set this device up in my office and then have a Rails app that would read from the database and kind of show me like the air quality and whatever else. And, you know, do a little bit of Rails, but mostly, you know, this low level Ruby stuff for fun.
That's awesome.
And yeah, it's been good. That will definitely absolutely become a tutorial once I get, I don't know if it'll probably be once I move, once the house is done. So
we'll be on the lookout for it. Cause that sounds awesome. I did just recently pick up a couple of little boards and microcontrollers and like having fun with them. But the only easy way to program them so far has been Python or C++, neither of which I'm I can do stuff in either one, but like I would love to be able to just dip into Ruby where I'm hyper comfortable and mess around, and like the stuff's either old or not maintained or not compatible with the new stuff. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm smart enough to be the guy, but I have a need. I might have to start digging into this, but
right. Yeah. There's a lot of little complicated things, like the protocols will show you like we're going to send you over these exact bytes and you've got to like parse them. I'd rather just grab a library most of the time for that stuff.
Same.
But if you ever just are bored on a weekend, it's actually super fun to like try and figure that out. Because if you start getting that low level, you start to realize like, oh, this is actually just as simple as everything else I've been doing, but it's like unreadable. And now it's readable. Like now I understand it. Those are some really good epiphany moments. And you start to realize like, yeah, what Tenderlove wrote for this UART library is fantastic, but you start to realize, oh, I could do that too. Like, instead of just grabbing the libraries. And I think that is another one of those moments where you're like, oh, this is cool. It's so simple. And it's really not something too complicated for me to understand. Like, I can actually do this. Builds up some good confidence. Solve. I'll be excited to hear what were the boards you picked up.
Let's see. I got a Badger.
Have you heard of the Badger? I've seen that.
2040. Yeah. Jamie Lawrence was walking around RailsConf with one. They're super cool, but that's another one where it's like the only good library for working with it was Python. And I was like busy with work. So I brought it with me, but just did not have time to get to it. And I have this other Adafruit microcontroller that I programmed to help me like, not help me, but to actually water my plants for me. It just detects when water saturation is low. And it was like a tutorial project. Like it wasn't me doing it, but it was just enough to like start dabbling. And I'm like, this is so much fun. I'm going to start buying way more than I need to. But like what you're doing. Like I want to build a thing that'll help me do X, Y, or Z. Well, I'm a programmer and I kind of understand how circuits work now. So I guess I'm going to do this. Yeah,
and you'd be surprised with how many tutorials are already out there that will get you 90% of the way, and maybe you have to change it a little bit for your own use case or whatever. But yeah, I didn't have an Arduino, but I know that the ESP32 is pretty much programmable with Arduino software. There's some tons of YouTube videos on the stuff too. But yeah, we'll have to hack on some stuff, some hardware stuff sometime.
Yeah.
Be fun.
That would definitely be
fun. It's definitely something that I've never really done before. Like I think in college we had a couple electrical engineering classes, and one of them was like building a very basic CPU, at least conceptually. And it was like, I don't know, an 8-bit CPU, so it didn't do a whole lot, but it's fascinating to actually like see, holy crap, when we're writing UART stuff, it's the binary coming across and we're doing basically the same kind of stuff that we were doing in, you know, our electrical engineering class, like building a processor. And I think that a lot of Rails devs struggle with this stuff, because if you only know Rails, or even if you only know Ruby, there's so much to building good Ruby or Rails applications that require you to understand, like, if I make this call, it's going to allocate a lot of memory. Or if I modify with a bang, like map with a bang instead, it'll do it in place and it might be considerably faster. But it's going to be a trade-off, and we have to decide, do we sacrifice the memory or whatever? And actually knowing those things when you're writing every line of code helps you write better software. Because I think there's, Colin would probably say that when we're pairing, there's like every line of code I write, I'm questioning like 10 different things about should we do it this way or not? And it's all these little things of, do we really want to allocate another string here, or can we like do something else? And little things like that are going through my head as I'm writing code, instead of just like going here to the end goal and thinking about every step of the way, how do we get there most efficiently? Or do we not care because we just want to get it working and then we can come back easily later and like make it more optimal? There are lots of decisions along the way.
What's the, you get it working, make it right, make it fast? Is that?
It sounds about right.
Something to that effect, where it's like the order in which like making it fast or performant is like the last thing you do before you release it.
It's very much like your red-green refactor process for tests.
Big time. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Cool. Well,
thank you so much for coming on the show. This was awesome. This was a blast. We could do this all day, but
easily.
I don't want to release a 2-hour episode. I mean, I do, but I don't know how many listens I will get to. Awesome. Well, so for those folks who don't already follow you on all the places, where can you be found on the internets?
You can find me probably most easily on Twitter, at exid3, E-X-C-I-D-3. You can find me literally anywhere with that username pretty much, and gorails.com. So that's it.
Great stuff. All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me. This was super fun.
Yeah, man. It was a blast. I'll talk to you later.
All right. See ya.